Iran says a Persian Gulf country will host the upcoming talks on the revival of JCPOA, and the ball is now in Washington's court. Russian forces step up their attacks to capture the last major cities still in the hands of Ukrainian troops in eastern Lugansk province. And a rights group says that Israeli forces have killed more than a dozen Palestinian children this year so far. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran confirms that a Persian Gulf country will be hosting the upcoming indirect talks with the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 deal, saying that a venue and the timing will be decided in the coming hours. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Washington has agreed to fulfill all its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and ensure Iran's economic benefits. Khatibzadeh said that was the message conveyed to Tehran by the EU foreign policy chief during his recent visit. The spokesman says that the upcoming talks with the U.S. will focus on the remaining issues and the removal of its sanctions on Iran. He said that Iran is ready to reverse the rollback of its nuclear commitments if Washington immediately returns to its relevant obligations. But Khatibzadeh says that the U.S. has shown it's not trustworthy, stressing that the ball is now in Washington's court. Iran and Iraq say that they have agreed to work together to help bring an end to the suffering of the people in Yemen through dialogue.
We believe without a doubt continuing this war is futile, as it only causes pain among the people, women and children included. This war should end as soon as possible, and the current ceasefire can be a step toward the settlement of issues in Yemen as well as intra-Yemeni talks.
The comments were made by Reis in a joint presser with Iraq's premier, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, following their meeting in Tehran. The president said that Tehran and Baghdad believe that regional states can solve the problems themselves through dialogue. He said the presence of foreign forces in the region only worsens the current problems. The Iranian president said that normalizing ties with a number of regional countries will not bring security for Israel. On bilateral ties, both leaders agreed to boost economic cooperation and trade. Reis said that the trip could be a turning point in the two countries' relations. The Iranian foreign ministry says his country wants nothing but good for the region, stressing that the solution to regional issues should be found within the region. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made a comment during a meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister. The top Iranian diplomat also thanked Iraq for its constructive role in the talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Amir Abdullahian said that Iran supports the reopening of the two countries' embassies in Tehran and Riyadh. He also pointed to relations between Iran and Egypt and said that reinforcing ties between Tehran and Cairo will benefit the whole region and the Islamic world. The Iraqi Prime Minister also highlighted the role of Iran in the region's development. Russian troops are advancing into the last major city still in the hands of Ukrainian forces in eastern Lugansk province. Media reports indicating that Russian forces are pushing into Lysychansk from five directions. Kiev says that Moscow, the forces are bombing the city in an attempt to cut off the area from the south. The capture of Lysychansk would give Russia full control over the Lugansk region. The advances came days after the Russian army took over the neighboring city of Severodonetsk. The key industrial hub was a scene of a strict battle for weeks before the Ukrainian army finally withdrew its forces. The Ukrainian capital was also hit by Russian missiles for the first time in 3 weeks. According to Ukrainian authorities, the attack killed one person and wounded six others. Civilians, including women and children, are withstanding the worst effects of the conflict in Ukraine. John Amitova just talked to attended a funeral ceremony for a six-year-old girl who was killed by the Ukrainian army's shelling in the eastern Donbass region.
A six-year-old girl lies in her coffin. Her name is Alina. She was killed by Ukrainian army shelling of the Donetsk region. Her family and the local community mourn together. As she's taken away to the burial site, her grandmother bids farewell to her beloved granddaughter for the last time. She asks for forgiveness.
Now, Alina was killed in this playground. Speaking to locals and the family, they tell me that she was killed because of a Ukrainian shell that was fired in this direction, and an anti-air defense missile fired by the Russians hit that missile in the mid-air, and shrapnel showered to the ground to kill Alina.
A few moments ago, there was the massive boom of the anti-air defense working. You can see the trace in the sky. Alina didn't die straight away. She was taken to hospital and died 2 days later. The clock has stopped at 6:12, the moment Alina's heart stopped beating. She arrives at the burial site. Her family say their final goodbyes.
Now, there's something particularly shocking about a child killed in war. Few people here can hold back the tears. While millions of people in NATO countries continue to encourage their governments to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of negotiating for peace, the fact of the matter is, the longer this war goes on, the more children like Alina will be killed.
A memorial in Donetsk. The sign reads, "To the children killed in Donbass since 2014. There is no end date, as children continue to die." This statue tells of a true story. A young boy sheltering his sister during shelling. He was killed. She survived. Mourners take their turn to pay their final respects. For 8 years, Ukraine has targeted and killed civilians here in Donetsk. President Zelensky, lionized in the West for defending European values, has continued the policy. Alina's whole life was lived during this war, a war now escalated by the Russian invasion and NATO's policy of arming Ukraine instead of pushing for negotiations. This is the true reality of war. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
A report shows that the Israeli regime has killed 15 Palestinian children since the beginning of this year, according to Defense for Children International. The figure includes 5 kids from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin alone. It also indicates that 17 children were arrested after homes in Jenin were stormed at night, while 6 others were injured. 6 Palestinian homes, which sheltered more than 16 children in several villages of Jenin, were demolished as well. The rights group says that Israel continues to commit crimes against Palestinian children with impunity. The organization is calling an international community to adopt prompt measures to prosecute Israel at international criminal courts. Hamas resistance movements warning Israel against getting into a military confrontation again, saying that Palestinian missiles will destroy the regime in a matter of minutes in case of a new Israeli adventurism. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by our guests earlier in our news review program.
Sign up for our news review segments where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The Hamas resistance movement says Palestinian missiles will destroy the Israeli regime in a matter of minutes in case of a new military confrontation. Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader, was addressing a forum in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Haniyeh said the Palestinian resistance is on the verge of victory despite challenges and changes. He said it was imperative to the Palestinians to remain united against Israeli aggression. Haniyeh said the Zionist regime is divided and in total political chaos. The Hamas leader hailed Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and other countries for defending their Islamic identity and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Haniyeh emphasized solidarity with Lebanon to protect its rights, especially in light of Israel's attempt to attack the Lebanese natural resources in the south. Joining us for more on that is Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, and also Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist from Toronto. Gentlemen, welcome. Robert, if I could start with you, you know, they say the first Palestinian intifada or uprising was with the stones, the second was with Kalashnikovs, and the third was with missiles. Taking into account what the Palestinian resistance leader there said, despite Israel also expanding its military with to the tune of billions of American taxpayers' money using weapons, the Palestinian resistance is also expanding its power. How much of a threat does that pose to Israel?
Well, I think it's an increasing threat to Israel. As you mentioned, the resistance over years has increased in from stones to sophisticated weaponry. Also, while Israel has made alliances with some Arab countries lately, as we all know, it's shocking, it never should have happened, but the people in those Arab countries oppose those alliances. So they will support Palestinian resistance when it's necessary to do so. Also, right now, the Israeli government is heading for its fifth election in 3 years. There is complete political chaos in Israel. It's a very disunited country, and so that these statements by the Hamas leader should be troubling to Israel, but Israel is still a powerful nation. However, the power that Hamas has in the Gaza Strip is unknown. So it's very possible that this statement by Ismail Haniyeh is accurate, and that we could see the victory of Palestine sooner rather than later.
Right. Eric, when you see the Palestinian resistance in the besiege of the Gaza Strip, also known as the largest open-air prison in the world, taking on and literally embarrassing the Israeli regime in their confrontations, should Israel be careful when it threatens the Palestinians and, in that context, other countries, considering the divisions that Robert there was touching on inside, the Israeli apartheid entity itself?
Well, really, Israel is not just sitting waiting. It's busy making an alliance with the Gulf states, and supposedly with Saudi Arabia, against Iran, particularly, and it hates the Palestinians and the Iranian support for Palestine and Hamas. So this is it's really a tough time, and Hamas is not blinking. It's basically standing up and making its defiance clear. So that's really important, and that is, I'm sure, troubling to Israel. But it's got the big guns, Israel, and if it succeeds with the Gulf states, I agree with Robert that the people are behind the Palestinians. It's just these puppet leaders in the Gulf and the Saudi leaders that are playing their games with Israel. So I think that they're not going to rush forward too much. I think they don't want to be seen to be lackeys of Israel. So it's a very tough situation now.
Okay, let's take a quick look and see what some social media posts have to say about this. Our first post says Israeli forces should never be in Palestine. They should remove the Zionist colonials from Palestinian land and just protect their border if there is a missile attack. And in kind, the response is completely legitimate. Next post says Israel should just be dismantled since they are the colonizers of Palestine, a land acknowledged by the ancient world since the time of the pharaohs. Then Israel wouldn't have to worry about rockets fired by indigenous resistance to genocide, colonization, and occupation. Final post here says, where there is occupation, apartheid, there is resistance. As simple as that. Long live the resistance, Hamas, and all resistance in occupied Palestine. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist from Kitchener, and Eric Wahlberg is an author and journalist from Toronto. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Now moving on, thousands of Spaniards have hit the streets to protest against NATO and the budget allocated by its member states to further reinforce the military alliance. And that happened ahead of a key NATO summit in Madrid.
We are at the demonstration because twice as much money is being spent on the army and militarism as before. And that money is being taken away from health, education, and many other things that we need more than the army and wars covered up by peace.
There are U.S. bases here in Spain. There are economic and military activities that affect our international strategy. And, obviously, the fact that Spain is part of a military alternative with a possible conflict with another military force affects the Spanish people.
According to protest organizers, around 5,000 people joined the march. They chanted slogans, holding placards in protest of NATO's expenditures on armaments. They were also critical of the presence of NATO bases in Spain. NATO member states will convene in Madrid next week to discuss the membership of Finland and Sweden. The two Nordic countries applied for accession in the wake of the Ukraine war and amid Russia's warning against NATO's eastward expansion. The British lawmakers are going to hold a second debate on proposals to overhaul a post-Brexit deal in Northern Ireland amid trade tensions with the European Union. The debate planned for later on Monday centers on unilaterally changing a protocol that creates a customs border between Northern Ireland and the other parts of the UK. London says the customs checks have been problematic and divisive. That amid the refusal by pro-British parties in Northern Ireland to join the local coalition government that London says is threatening peace in the province. The EU has warned of an all-out trade war if the UK moves to unilaterally change what they are already agreed to. The EU says such a move is illegal and damaging to mutual trust. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello! I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company!
I am now at the airport and I'm late as always. I hope that the gate is still open and I arrive on time. Oh, thank you, God. The flight's gate is still open. Oh, my today's destination is Sistan and Baluchistan province. I'm going to visit one of the extraordinary archaeological sites of Iran. Shahr Sukhte, literally, the burnt city. Shahr Sukhte is the remains of an ancient city in Iran. This city was built on the alluvium of the estuary of the Hirmand River to Lake Hamun. Shahr Sukhte is located 120 kilometers south of the city of Zabul. This large city was built in Bronze Era, and Iranians used to live in this city almost 6,000 years ago. The total area of the city is 280 hectares and is divided into residential, central, and industrial areas, as well as monuments and cemetery. These areas are situated in the form of successive hills. The ancient area of Shahr Sukhte is about 18 meters higher than the land surrounding it. Shahr Sukhte used to be an advanced city at its time. The remains of Shahr Sukhte shows that this city had a well-managed system for water supply and sewage. This unique heritage was registered by the UNESCO World Heritage List in 2014. I am now near Shahr Sukhte site. Here we have the scenery of desert, and there is no tree here except tamarisk trees. Though 5,000 years BC, this region had a diverse flora. This region used to have abundant weeping willow, maple, and white poplar trees. In order to see the remains of Shahr Sukhte, I have to go up this hill. I am now in the area of the cemetery. There are triangular forms here. I think they're made of adobe. Archaeologists have found traces of cloth in these graves. These fabrics were used either for wrapping the dead or in the form of underlays and covers for the dead. In these graves, many pottery objects have been discovered. One of these well-known pottery artifacts is a pottery vessel with a drawing of a goat and a tree. Giving the vessel a spin, one would see a goat leaping to snatch leaves from a tree. This can be recognized as the first animation movie in the world. I am now standing beside the grave number 6705. In this grave, the skeleton of a robust woman with her left eye being artificial was found. On this artificial eyeball, the eye's capillaries are made with thin gold wires. This artificial eye is one of the great wonders of the world. You might have asked yourself why this city is called the Burnt City. Researchers say Shahr-e Sukhte used to be an industry which had a lot of furnaces. Therefore, ash was found due to the activity of industrial furnaces around the city. And when archaeologists first spotted ash in this city, they came to the idea to call this city Shahr-e Sukhte, literally the burnt city. Actually, the real name of this city is not known yet. The wonders of Shahr-e Sukhte are a lot, and researchers are still studying this ancient city. One of the most significant conclusions derived from these findings is that the inhabitants of Shahr-e Sukhte had been really civilized and peace-seeking people. Well, our beautiful Iran is, of course, full of wonders and beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has visited Iran for high-level talks. This trip is in line with Iran's initiative to expand and enhance relations with regional countries. The trip comes one day after he traveled to Saudi Arabia, and his trip to Tehran is, in a sense, a bid to revive talks between Riyadh and Tehran, amongst other things. In this edition of The Spotlight, relations between the two countries, Iraq's Saudi-Iran mediation efforts, and how Iran and Iraq have agreed to work together to help bring an end to the suffering of the people in Yemen will be discussed. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saad Al-Mutalabi from the Iraq State of Law Coalition joins us from Baghdad. Also joining us is Brian Terrell. He's a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Malloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Saad Al-Mutalabi, let me first start with you. We're looking at, obviously, a very significant visit here being made by Iraq's prime minister, coming at a point in time where there's some regional alliances that are taking place. Iran has taken the initiative in terms of enhancing relations with regional countries. And the Iranian president saying that this trip could be a turning point in Iran-Iraq relations. Why would the Iranian president say that, do you think?
Yeah, thank you very much. I do believe that this is a historic visit. It culminates years of negotiation on behalf of Iran, or bringing together the Iranian and Saudi Arabian officials to negotiate in Baghdad. There were a series of meetings, and these meetings have finally reached a positive outcome in re-strengthening or re-bringing the security and stability back to the Middle East. As you know, Iran is the most important country in the region, and having strained relations with Saudi Arabia definitely works against the stability of the region, and particularly in the stability of Iraq. So we definitely welcome this outcome. We welcome the economic forecast that may be cultivated by this visit, and we hope that there will be a future endeavors to bringing not only the end to the suffering of the civilians in Yemen, but also to resolve any issues between Iran and Saudi Arabia, also to assist Iraq in the matter of water, irrigation, and the rivers that originate from Iran and now been diverted inside the Iranian land, and Iraq has been deprived of these waters. So all these definitely paint a better future, a better understanding, and hopefully a better result for all concerned countries in the region.
Sure. Well, let's break some of those angles down, Brian Terrell, that our guest talked about. And he talked about how Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Iraqi prime minister, actually came to Iran after going to Saudi Arabia. One of the goals there, obviously, to revive talks between the two countries, in which he said the two nations have agreed to seek stability in West Asia. How do you see this forging of ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which has been going on since last year? Five times at this point, direct negotiations were hosted by Baghdad, which commenced back in April 2021. How do you view it?
Well, I pray that it helps bring stability into the region, and it's a very dangerous time with the Ukraine war, the war in Ukraine endangering the shipments of fuel, and then of course of wheat in this coming year. The look at starvation in Afghanistan, especially, and in Yemen, it looks very, very bad, and there needs to be peace. One of the things that's encouraging to me, unfortunately, as an American, I have to say, is that the United States is not brokering this. And when the U.S. is brokering negotiations, it doesn't bode well, because we're really, the U.S. is looking for markets. I'm very disturbed. On the other side, a development that's not encouraging is King Abdullah of Jordan suggesting a NATO-like coalition alliance in the region. I've been very much involved in the protests in Europe of NATO, and so seeing the existence, continuing existence, and the extension of NATO into Europe has only exacerbated the problem and raised tensions. Everybody knew in 1993, even Senator Joe Biden in 1993 said that the extension of NATO would lead to trouble with Russia, and of course it has. But that's been a treasure trove for Lockheed Martin and Boeing, sure, and the other war makers, the other war profiteers.
Right. Well, when you talk about that, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi and also the Prime Minister Kadhimi, Saeed al-Mutallabi, have talked about the regional security, in which cooperation amongst countries can solve the problems, and that can be obviously done through dialogue, emphasizing, especially coming from Iran, that the presence of foreign forces actually is one of the reasons why the region is experiencing the current problems. And one of the countries contributing to that is the U.S. When it comes to the cooperation between Iran and Iraq, that has been steadfast, except for the U.S. and its presence on Iraqi soil. How do you see that evolving at this point, given the fact that we have had Iraq actually voting for U.S. forces to leave the country? I mean, is that something that's going to ultimately happen completely?
Yeah, this is one of the most important issues. Why we see major political parties in Iraq not backing Mr. al-Kadhimi, the present prime minister, because on his stand on or his position on the U.S. forces and other issues, which maybe is not the place to speak about them in the media. But definitely, there are a number of issues that the political parties in the Iraqi parliament consider Mr. Kadhimi as unfit for a second term. And they have resisted all attempts from internal and external efforts to grant Mr. Kadhimi a second term in office. And one of these issues that we take very dearly in our heart is the presence of the American troops and the presence of their drones in the air and creating the problems they have created. They have attacked a number of public mobilization units, bases, and killed a number of our martyrs or of our troops. So, yes, definitely there is an issue with that. And the issue of the American presence in Iraq is high, very high, on the agenda of the political parties here in Baghdad and Iraq, and not only political parties, but also the way Mr. Kadhimi have dealt with issues, internal issues in Iraq. There is a consensus among people that he should not be granted a second term.
Interesting. Well, Brian Terrell, when we look at the way that the U.S. Is functioning in the region, what are we looking at, really, in terms of landscape? And in this context, I'd like for you to answer the way that Iran and Iraq have, again, forged their ties administration after administration. At this point, this 13th administration, headed by Ebrahim Raisi, Iran's president, is very keen on enhancing and further developing the ties between Iran and Iraq. But the U.S. forces remain somewhat of a thorn. At the same time, the U.S. Is very inactive, in a sense. Or are they just inactive at this point, not knowing where the foreign policy is going to go when it comes to Iraq?
Well, there's the very presence of U.S. troops, as the other speaker has pointed out, is very destabilizing. And the war has been continuing, as President Biden put it about Afghanistan when the U.S. troops left there, is that the war continues over the horizon. He's saying, you know, with drones and with fighter bombers, and then there's special forces as well. All this is going on. The U.S. has never backed down from the war in Yemen. Even the initiatives that some in Congress have made to have the U.S. stop cooperating with the Saudi UAE war in Yemen, every one of those initiatives going before Congress has had an exception to any and so-called anti-terrorism efforts being made by special forces in Yemen. So these wars are going on subtly and quietly, and we're not hearing about them all the time, but fighting is, you know, the U.S. is involved in all these places. Back in February of 2001, Joe Biden's very first foreign policy address, he joined the world community in condemning the Saudi coalition's war in Yemen very, very clearly, and said what a disaster it is, a humanitarian disaster, a crime.
Sure.
And that it would stop, but it didn't. You know, within months, there were billions of dollars of business with Lockheed Martin selling the Saudis missiles. The stability of the region is not a goal of the United States, because the stability of the region means that that the arms manufacturers, which is really the biggest part of our economy, one of the only real now that we're buying everything from China, one of the only contributions the United States has to the world economy is the production and selling of weapons. And as the head of Raytheon said when Biden was elected, said, "Don't worry, peace is not going to break out anytime soon," mm-hmm. and said specifically about the Middle East, it will remain an area of solid growth. So this is the wars and instability is an opportunity for solid growth for the U.S. economy, and peace breaking out is seen as the existential threat. And sure. we're on the verge of nuclear war with Russia. We need a very big change of direction is certainly necessary.
Sure. Well, let's look at Saad al-Mutalabi. When it comes to the security of the region, one of the things that stands out are the activities of Israel. I mean, we could talk about how it attacks Syria repeatedly. But we need to expand more about how certain alignments are going to work out when you're seeing Arab countries normalize ties with Israel. Now, when it comes to Iran's stance, that's pretty clear. Iraq has actually not only rejected calls for normalization with Israel, that happened last year. If you remember, there was a conference that was held in Erbil, actually. They actually said that violators of the anti-Israel law could face penalties of life imprisonment or even the death sentence. So Iraq has made itself also very clear. But how can there be normalizations with other countries? How could there be a relationship with other countries when you have Israel and them normalizing ties? We could talk about the UAE or Bahrain. And, of course, there is a relationship, though not out in the open diplomatically, but behind the scenes between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Now we are worried. We are facing the next hurdle in a few days, which is the regional summit in Saudi Arabia, where Iraq was invited, alongside with the Emirates, of course, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and other Gulf states. The speech or the talks now is about forming an Arab NATO kind of model. And Iraq, definitely, we've politically, at least in the parliament, we've declared that the Iraqi political parties declared that Mr. Kadhimi has no right to sign any such agreement because he is a caretaker government. He's not a fully fledged prime minister at the moment, and he is acting as a caretaker for the Iraqi government. So without the authorization of the parliament, he should not or he cannot take part or sign any such agreement. We are worried about that because that may put us in jeopardy or put us in a position to be seemingly against the United States or against the United Arab Front, that we know it is based upon the continuous aggression or the possible aggression against Iran, or as they say, defense against Iran. So we definitely do not want Iraq to be part of that. And we are worried that Mr. Kadhimi will take steps towards that. It's not 100% normalization with the Israeli regime, but at least he'll be a friend with those who normalized relationship with Israel. So we have this hurdle, and it is taking quite a lot of efforts here sure. in the political arena in Iraq.
When you talk about Arab NATO, first of all, Brian Terrell, the last time around that fell flat. It didn't happen. It didn't take off the ground. So I'm curious mm-hmm. as to why there should be an Arab NATO in the first place. Are we really looking at the fact that this is a requirement of either the U.S. or led by the U.S. To have regional countries line up together for what? Who do they need to be afraid of? Do you have to have all these countries? I mean, if you talk about Iran being that kind of threat, which it's not. Mm-hmm. But it would take, what, all these countries to have to form together because they're afraid of Iran? You tell us why that would be considered that way when Iran was at the forefront of having some of these Daesh terrorists not penetrate into countries like Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just as the necessity of NATO in Europe after the early 1990s, if there ever was a reason for it, they say that now NATO exists primarily in order to deal with the instability and the problems caused by its existence. And so if there's not a lot of problems now, there certainly are, but it's only going to be exacerbated by the existence of a so-called Arab NATO. It's going to be, of course, it's going to be seen as a threat to Iran. And of course, there'll need to be responses to it. And it will be, it will create its own problems. But it's the alliances are, and it's anti-democratic. As we're talking about what's going on with the parliament in Iraq, it's happening in Europe. There's six countries now in NATO that have U.S. nuclear weapons, and this is without the approval or even the official knowledge of the governments of the civil governments. It's arrangements between the U.S. military and the militaries of Netherlands and Germany and some others that these countries are hosting nuclear weapons without the without the consent of a civil elected government. So it's an anti. I see the same kind of thing going on here. It's as anti-democratic.
You touched on that word nuclear, and the only entity that is in possession of that, Saddam Talib, is Israel. So who's the threat?
Well, obviously we know, the world know that Israel is the threat in the region, and the most important ally to Israel is the United States. So we are all victims here, but we definitely do not want Iraq to be part of any form of alliance that
right.
may jeopardize
I'm going to jump in, Saddam Talabi, because you used the word victim, and since we're running out of time, when you say victim, the ones that have normalized ties with Israel, do you think that they're realizing, based on, again, what Iran has said, in a sense, that they are falling victim to Israel and the fact that perhaps they may be used just in terms of security, and that's why Israel is interested in order for its own livelihood and its own existence, that it needs to do this, do you think?
Yes, I do think so. I think that the scaremongering that's been going on in the region politically, you can't forget that the Americans have a very strong media arms. And this long arm of the United States and its allies in Europe has a devastating effect on particularly the social media, scaremongering, that the sectarian issues, Shia, Sunnis, all that. So that is basically, they are now victims of the scaremongering of the media arm of the West. And unfortunately, they really don't know what they don't know what they're doing, or they are being threatened that their existence rely on that. And you have to remember, these are non-democratic countries. Mm-hmm. These are countries, monarchs and emirs, and they are basically holding the throne by a thread. And if they are against America, then, well, you know, that could devastate their position.
We're having the U.S. president visit the region soon, from what we understand, Brian Terrell. I'm curious as to how that's going to go in terms of the meeting that is supposed to be taking place between the U.S. president and Saudi Arabia. But when we take a look at the timing of this, it's not as if Saudi Arabia has even received the U.S. that well. We're looking at the alignments that have taken place, realignments, and the enhancements of ties that Iran has pursued vigorously with the regional countries. How does all of that fit in with the West Asia region, which and some call it the Middle East?
I find it hard to view this visit as anything really diplomatic. I think it's almost like a sales, and I think it'll be looking for for entities to buy weapons from the United States. It's really the biggest investors in our elections are the weapons manufacturers. And in a sense, that's Joe Biden's job is to sell weapons, even when it's putting the American people as well as the people of West Asia in peril.
Okay, final question to you, Saddam Mutalibi. The relationship between Iran and Iraq has been solid for quite some time. There have been some hiccups along the way, especially when the U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump, was there. Do you think that the U.S. still has an initiative to use Iraq as a base in order to, as the former U.S. president said, spy on Iran or to oversee Iran's activities? And will Iraq, the new Iraq under Khamenei, allow that?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And what we are worried about, that the new agreement in Saudi Arabia will be part of that, and making Iraq again, as they call it, the guardian of the Eastern Gate. Well, we don't want to be guardian of any gate, east and south or north. We want to prosper. We want to live. We want to have good relationship with all our neighbors. We want prosperity for the people of Iraq. We want to live like all other countries. And we definitely feel that there is such intentions, either American or maybe Gulf states, would want to push Iraq into that position.
Thank you for that, Saddam Mutalibi. Iraq's State of the Law Coalition from Baghdad. Brian Terrell, thank you so much. Political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners all over the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions on different issues in Islam. And for that, we are trying to invite different scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Like recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Murtala Karimi, a researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the question that we shall pose today. Before starting our discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh Murtala to the show. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us to have you here, Sheikh. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtala Karimi, is about the existence of souls in animals. It has been asked, dear brothers and sisters, that do animals such as cats and dogs have souls? This is what we are going to start our discussion with, and later, inshallah, we shall go to the next part of this question, where it says that if they have, then what happens to their souls when they will die, when they die? If a person has a beloved pet which died in dunya, in this world, if that person dies and goes to heaven, can he ask for his pet alive there from Allah the Almighty? So can he or she ask for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bring him back that pet? This is a question that we wanted to find the answer from the explanations of Sheikh Murtala Karimi. Sheikhana?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When it comes to whether the animals have soul or not, we have the concept of ruh or nafs in especially Islamic philosophy. And the Muslim philosophers, they believe that we have three kinds of soul or nafs or ruh: the plant soul, the animal soul, and the human one.
Yes.
So the short answer to this question, to the first question, is that yes, the animals, they also have the soul, but it doesn't mean that that soul is completely like the soul of the human beings. No.
Okay.
So we may call it three stages of the soul, or nafs.
Mm-hmm.
We have, as I mentioned, the plant soul. So also the plants have a kind of nafs, a nafs on nabati, which means that, they have nutrition, they have growth, and somehow they have reproduction. I mean, by reproduction for the plants, I mean that we can have some seeds for other plants. Then the higher stage is the animal soul. For the animal soul, the characteristic is that we can have the perception of details and also voluntary movements.
Yeah.
These two are not available for the plants. But for the animal soul, we have the perception of details and also the voluntary movement, which means that the nafs of animal, or if you may call it the soul, is higher than that of the plants.
Yeah.
But is it the same as the human beings? Of course not. The soul of the human beings is, again, a higher one because of the fact that we are able to think and contemplate. And that is why the human beings are called as the thinking animals.
Right.
So, yes, the animals have a kind of soul, but in a lower stage and value than the soul of the human beings. Now, there is big discussion and hot discussion among the Muslim scholars, especially in theology and philosophy, whether the animals will be resurrected on the Day of Judgment or not. Because mm-hmm. the question is talking about whether we can have our pet in the heaven or not.
Yeah.
So it's a lengthy discussion, but I prefer to talk about different details so that we can have a kind of comprehensive answer to this question.
Yes, please.
Once for all. First of all, so we proved that, yes, the animals also have a kind of soul. Now, the question is that, who is going, for the human beings, we know that the archangel Israel is the angel for taking the life of the human being at the time of the death. And mm-hmm. of course, he has some angels working, with his supervision. But now the question is that, is it the case for animals too? Do we have an angel like Israel? Now, answering this question and the next question, that whether the animals will be resurrected or not, let me give a short answer and a clear answer that there is a kind of difference among the scholars.
Yeah.
So some believe that they will be resurrected and some believe that they will not be resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
Do we mean to come to a conclusion and decisive answer to this question? No, it's not one of the fundamental beliefs.
Yeah.
So my point is that it's a matter of dispute among the Muslim scholars answering this question. Because of the fact that we do not have, clear verses and narrations specifically talking about this question. Yeah. And each group, they have referred to some verses and narrations just to confirm their viewpoint. I share the arguments of both groups and we leave the conclusion to our dear listeners.
Yeah.
Questions and Answers in Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah.